This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us. And today, we start with you.
Hi, this is Nina Hoffman calling from Charleston, South Carolina. If I were hit with an emergency, I would be able to handle it. We have health insurance, homeowners, and flood. And while we don't have any savings, we could get as much credit as we might need. But what's scary is that now we are in the minority of the populace. What point might we become part of the majority?
My name is Tracy. I'm from Wells. No, we are not prepared. We live paycheck to paycheck. I'm on disability for my MS, and my husband has a small construction business. Ever since the recession, when my husband lost his job, we have been struggling.
Hi, my name is Chris from Millbrae, California. Me, my wife, and daughter are all financially prepared for any natural disasters or unexpected health issues. We have excellent employment, financial independence, and top-notch insurance covering our health and property. No worries at all.
Hi, this is Paul calling from China Township, Michigan. My answer is absolutely not. We're still paying on thousands of dollars in medical bills because of a $6,000 deductible. Thank you, Obamacare. We live hand-to-mouth, even with two incomes. We'd survive somehow, as we always do, but we just might be paying on our debt till we go to the grave.
Are you and your family prepared for an emergency? That's the question we asked in the wake of Harvey and its devastating aftermath. The storm made landfall as a hurricane last Friday and has now left a trail of destruction across Texas and the Gulf. Scientists at the University of Wisconsin Space Science and Engineering Center are calling this a 1,000-year flood event. The damage to infrastructure and to people's lives in some ways is unfathomable. It's the kind of disaster few of us could ever truly prepare for. And in the weeks ahead, the financial costs will become a reality for millions of people. According to a new survey conducted by the Harris Poll and The Takeaway, only 10% of 1,200 American adults said they are very prepared for a natural disaster. Now, preparedness can mean a lot of things, and we're going to return to those findings in just a minute. But first, let's address financial vulnerability across America. That can come from a catastrophe like Harvey, but much more often, it's just a part of everyday life. Jonathan Mordick is a professor of public policy and economics at the NYU Wagner School. He's co-author of The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. And Courtney Collins is the lead reporter of the One Crisis Away Project from KERA Radio in Dallas. They've been tracking North Texans living on the financial edge for more than 4 years. And Courtney says it's not about being rich or poor. It's about the unexpected problems of daily life that can destroy a family's finances.
One crisis away doesn't mean that you're struggling with poverty and homelessness necessarily. Being one crisis away could mean that you have a job, but you have no savings. It could mean that you have two incomes, but you're so tightly budgeted that if anything changes, if there's any disruption to your finances, you're going to be kind of on the financial edge and have a major life disaster occur as a result. And what we're finding is that more and more people are living in what's known as asset poverty, meaning they really don't have the resources socked away to last more than about 3 months after a disruption to their finances.
Jonathan, how much savings does the average American family have to deal with an emergency situation? And how far away, if there's a way to know this, are average American families from the kind of financial crisis that Courtney's talking about?
The savings data is a little bit complicated, and we often have a go-to number, which isn't actually that useful. It's our U.S. savings rate, and that's about 5.7%. But it doesn't, that's an average. So the averages aren't that revealing. What's really more revealing are surveys which are starting to show, for example, that a third of Americans report having no savings at all, or 44% of Americans couldn't cover $400 if an emergency hit them. It's those kinds of numbers which are starting to get people to, you know, sit up and look at this differently.
But Jonathan, the American way is you might have a tight income, tight expenses, you save, you scrimp, you're not extravagant, you get by, get that better job, get that promotion, and before you know it, you'll be more comfortable. You won't be on the verge of crisis. Isn't that how it's supposed to be?
That's exactly how it's supposed to be. And you know what's interesting is we see households in our own work, and we have a study where we followed American families from different parts of the U.S. We see them saving, just like they're supposed to do. But because of the ups and downs, and some of them, you know, of the sort that Courtney's describing, because of those ups and downs, the saving is getting depleted. So they're actively trying to save through the year, but they're not ending up with accumulations. And that's leaving them vulnerable when those big things happen.
Courtney, let's talk about some of the big things, because you reported on the wave of tornadoes that tore through Texas in 2015 and some of the people who survived those storms. Of course, we've been talking all week about the devastation on the other side of Texas down in Houston and the surrounding area, and so many people who lost their homes. We don't even know the extent of that damage yet. Talk about those big shocks and what they can mean for people.
And I just actually revisited some of those families this week after Hurricane Harvey because I wanted to check in with them and kind of get their take on the situation. And it's really interesting. When the tornadoes came through, it was the day after Christmas in 2015. You know, you had two categories of people, people that had insurance and people that didn't. You know, we all know that renters aren't required to carry insurance a lot of the time. And we did have a family that we followed that had no renter's insurance at all. Their rental house was torn to pieces. They lost everything inside of it. And worse still, the husband in that family had a job as a general contractor, had a work truck full of tools, and only carried liability insurance on it. He had no full coverage. So when that truck got smashed by the tornado, all those tools and the truck itself were gone, and he had to replace those things out of pocket because they had no coverage, no full coverage on that truck, just the required minimum liability insurance. So that was a big shock, obviously, to that family. They went from having a house full of things, a kitchen full of food, closets full of clothes, to nothing. And no real way to replace it. It's not like they had a savings. There was a reason they didn't carry those kinds of insurances. It's because they were so tightly budgeted that they just could not part with that money each month. They used it for bills and food. And so they were in a real bind. Then we talked to a lot of people that were underinsured, where they had either renter's insurance on their apartment or homeowner's coverage on their duplex or home. But when the time came to rebuild, they just really couldn't see how their coverage was going to stretch through to a full rebuild. You know, North Texas has a really hot housing market. And when there's a disaster, contractors go quickly, building supplies go quickly, and it's hard to rebuild. It's expensive. And people don't naturally go scrutinize their insurance policy every 6 to 12 months. They don't necessarily go through it anytime they make a big purchase or add a family member. You just don't ever really think it's going to happen to you. That's what the folks I talked to said over and over again. While they felt like they could handle it, and while, of course, they had some safeguards in place, it just never really occurred to them that they'd be picking through rubble at their house one day.
Jonathan, we talked yesterday with an expert on flood insurance who was looking at the Houston area, and only 2 out of every 10 homes in that area are covered by flood insurance. Now everybody's situation is different, but when you look at that broad picture of non-insurance for homes, you must see thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are going to be faced with a crisis here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this is something that the nation as a community is going to have to help the Houston community deal with. I think what Houston and the problems that we're seeing today are highlighting is a much broader phenomenon. It's those devastating moments. It's also health issues. A lot of people have insurance, as Courtney's saying, but not enough. So often having, you know, insurance that has high deductibles and high co-insurance, which means that when something happens, they have insurance, but it doesn't pay out that much, or they're huge out-of-pocket expenses. And so we're seeing Americans, you know, skipping medical treatments. About a quarter of Americans report they skipped medical treatments they needed because it was just too costly. So there's insurance, but the markets aren't really working so well for households that are really squeezed.
Courtney, outside of the disaster zone that we've been looking at this week, how important is medical insurance and the quality of health coverage to being one crisis away in America?
I've seen time and time again that medical expenses are a big reason that people are struggling. What's interesting to me, though, is it hasn't been families complaining about not having insurance or not having good enough insurance. It's just the fact that there's so many people that have to pony up, say, $1,200 to get a surgery, and they do it because that's part of their deductible and they haven't met it yet. But that $1,200 that they've now put toward that surgery is either out of savings or is out of their general expense account, and all of a sudden, they're throwing stuff on the credit cards. We had a couple that we chronicled in the very first chapter of our One Crisis Away series almost 4 years ago, and they were young. They had a little boy, and right after their son was born, Isaac, who is the husband, he got very, very sick. And they found out he had a really rare blood disorder, and he was basically out of the workforce from that day forward. He was in and out of the hospital for a couple of years, and he passed away. And when that happened to that family, they went from two earners to one. She ended up renting out their home to someone just to make some money, moved in with her parents with their little boy, and says that when the medical bills comes, she literally stacks them on the table and puts them in a drawer when the stack gets too high because she can't afford to pay them.
Jonathan, what are the types of things that American families are skipping or foregoing or just doing without as the bills stack up or as they're trying to meet month-to-month expenses before the crisis even comes?
So there's a lot of juggling. And what we've seen in our work following families over a year is that households have been pretty adept at trying to figure out, you know, which bills they can pay or not pay without getting things cut off. And so the big things often are medical. Some food gets cut. We see that, you know, when people are running out of food before the next paycheck, you know, consumption really does take a dip. It's basic necessities which are getting cut. And that's a tough equation, especially, you know, a family with kids trying to keep everything together.
I jump in and say families are also really creative with, they know how long their grace periods are on all of their bills. I talked to a woman who says she literally has a chart and she knows how many days over she can go on each payment before it gets reported a credit, before she actually gets a late fee assessed. And she takes it to the down to the quick every single month. And her famous line is, my month is so much longer than my paycheck is.
Courtney, we're talking a lot about the financial pressure and the financial stress on families. That's only part of it. I mean, the psychological and emotional toll when you're going through this type of financial stress has to be enormous, and it has to be enormous on kids as well.
I've been told that. I've been told that poverty is trauma. We know that kids in poverty start kindergarten about a year behind their peers. Something really interesting I was told by someone who works at the school here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that kind of emphasizes social emotional health and caters to low-income kids, is she told me that living in poverty, the feeling a child has is equivalent to what you and I feel if we slam on the brakes on the highway to try to avoid a car crash. That feeling you get where your heart kind of leaps into your throat and your pulse races, that's how a child living in poverty feels constantly. Imagine living with that as a seven-year-old day in and day out. That's why they call it toxic stress. And that's why I think it erodes so many of these kids' skills early on and why they start school so behind.
So where do people start? If wages aren't rising for working families as fast as they used to, nowhere near as fast, what can they do?
It's a tough equation. And it does have to come down to pulling down debt and trying to save more. I think the big problem is that a lot of the policy and a lot of the financial products that are available don't really fit households that are in these unstable situations. And so we're starting to see some approaches, for example, new technologies that are run through a smartphone and track what a household's income is doing month by month and is automatically pulling some money out when income is unnaturally high or abnormally high and putting that into savings automatically. What doesn't work is the usual advice, which is, you know, save automatically a given chunk of your income because that chunk, you know, may not be there month to month, depending on how big your paycheck is. So you need something that's much more active and that rides up and down with the ups and downs of incomes. So technology can help, but there are also things that, you know, policy can do. For example, we have lots of help saving up for retirement if you've got a job with a retirement policy. One thing that we could imagine is a similar kind of policy that would help people build up emergency savings.
What would that look like, an emergency savings policy?
Well, there's a really interesting idea that's been floated, which is something called a sidecar account, so that every month, you know, as a few percentage of your income is put into a retirement account, another percentage or so goes into an emergency savings account. So it just comes off the top.
Should Americans be able to save in a sidecar account tax-free?
That is a really interesting question. Right now, we have lots of subsidies for saving, and it's mostly going to richer people. It would be a great thing to see more of that kind of support and subsidy going to, you know, the struggling bottom half of the American population.
Jonathan Mordick is professor of public policy and economics at NYU and co-author of The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. And Courtney Collins is lead reporter on the One Crisis Away project from KERA Public Radio in Dallas. We return now to that Harris poll that I mentioned at the top of our program today. In a survey of 1,200 people that Harris conducted with The Takeaway, Americans are split on whether they're prepared for a natural disaster like Hurricane Harvey. The survey also revealed that Americans will most often turn to a family member and personal resources if a crisis like Harvey were to strike them. About a third said they would depend on family, while 16% would rely on insurance, and just 15% would go to a personal emergency fund. Those are just some of the findings. So for more on the results, we turn to John Gersma. He's CEO of the Harris Poll. John, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks, Todd.
You at the Harris Poll surveyed 1,200 Americans, as I mentioned, on their perceptions of how prepared they feel for a natural disaster like Harvey. What did you find?
Well, surprisingly, Americans are split down the middle about whether or not they feel that they are prepared for a disaster such as Hurricane Harvey. And you see that 50% say that they're very or somewhat prepared, but the other half of us say that we're not at all or not too prepared.
What do we know about what being prepared actually means? Because being prepared could be everything from I have a disaster kit, I have a plan, and I have a bunch of flashlights to, you know, I have $10,000 in savings for something like this.
Well, that's what gets really interesting in this, Todd, is that when you go inside the numbers, you actually see that there's a lack of confidence of Americans feeling that they've got a personal plan in place. In fact, only 10% of the country feel they're very prepared for a natural disaster. And with 41% of us saying that we feel unprepared for a long-term power outage or other event, you know, where that would require food, water, or supplies for more than 3 days.
What are some of the regional differences you found? Are there differences north to south?
There are. What I thought was quite interesting was depending on where you live, perhaps for most notably in the south, where 57% of folks in the south said that they felt they were very or somewhat prepared. Again, you know, somewhat follows sort of the patterns of whether or not natural disasters tend to be more of a function of the region that you live in, and that becomes more of a cultural aspect of where you are.
So I was struck by this finding that very few people, or relatively few people, I should say, plan to rely on their own savings or even on insurance coverage that they might have. A lot of people in this survey said they would turn to family or friends. That doesn't necessarily tell you the resources that family or friends have available. So dig into those numbers for us a little bit.
Sure, Todd. I thought what was also interesting was that a big part of this worry seems to be having a safety net. As you mentioned, only 15% of Americans have and believe they could turn to a personal emergency fund, or 16% feel that they can rely on insurance. So really what they tend to be doing is focusing on their family in the event of a crisis.
And I assume we can't know too much about how many of those people have insurance that they won't use, or how many people can afford insurance or just don't have it.
No, we don't have that inside the data. But I thought what was quite interesting was when we asked this question around where would you turn to for support in terms of your local community. And surprisingly, only 10% of us said that we would turn to our local communities. And yet, 62% of Americans reported that they were very or somewhat confident in their local community to respond to a natural disaster, such as what we've had in Houston this week.
So there's a disconnect there. People are confident that their communities could help them, but they still seem kind of individualistic, at least in their predictions of how they would act.
Yeah, I think so. I think what perhaps they're saying is that we are all of us are sort of caught up in our own world with our own devices, and yet when we stop and really survey the loss and devastation of the events this week, as Americans have been following what's been happening in the Houston region, you suddenly start to remember and recollect, you know, the power of ordinary Americans to come together.
John Gersma is CEO of the Harris Poll. They're a public opinion, market research, and strategy firm that conducted this poll of 1,200 Americans with The Takeaway. John Gersma, thanks.
Thanks, Todd.